Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Hey everyone, today we have a fun follow-up to last week's episode with Johnny Eccles from the band Love. This week, we'll hear Rick interview the last two living members of The Doors, guitarist Robbie Krieger and drummer John Densmore, about coming up in the LA rock scene alongside Love, who The Doors idolized and then later eclipsed. The Doors formed in 1965 and burned white hot until the death of their larger-than-life lead singer Jim Morrison. They released 6 albums in only 5 years. And in that brief time as a band, The Doors quickly became one of the biggest acts of the 60s. Their anti-flower power appeal was accentuated by Jim Morrison's brooding lyrics and keyboardist Ray Manzarek's frenzied organ licks. On today's episode, Rick Rubin talks to Robbie Krieger and John Densmore about their tumultuous history with Jim Morrison, who John refers to as a kamikaze drunk. Both Robbie and John recall LSD-fueled stories from their early gigs with The Doors and the role Acapulco Gold played in Jim Morrison's songwriting process. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin with Doors guitarist Robbie Krieger and drummer John Densmore.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I thought it would be interesting to talk about the album Love Forever Changes, because I love that album, and it seems unusual.
Yeah.
First of all, it doesn't sound like even Love's other records. The ones earlier were more rock.
Yeah.
And then Forever Changes was more acoustic, but classical as well.
Yeah, they had some good players on that record, too. But that's when they were kind of started fighting among themselves, right?
Yes. And,
yeah, you could kind of tell that.
It's interesting also that the Beatles were sort of not in a great place when they made the White Album with each other, and it's one of the best. Mm. There's something about when there's friction in a band, something good seems
to... You don't have to tell us about
that. That's why we are so big, let me tell you. Oh, my God.
I don't think of you guys as having friction. Again, I don't know
it
anything.
It was 3-1 the whole time. Jim, what is he going to do tonight? Oh, my God. Just craziness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he being provocative for the sake of being provocative, or he was just being himself?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was part of it. He liked to, you know, get people's goats.
But you guys as well, or no?
Sure.
He would. He would like...
Yeah, after a while.
Like winding you
he
up.
He knew that it wouldn't work after a while with us, but it didn't stop him from trying.
I remember when I met his sister, and she said, you know, my brother growing up was always pressing our buttons. Did he do that to you guys? Duh. Testing. Let's see what boundary, where the boundaries are or whatever.
What would be an example of something that would happen that would you would find questionable?
Let's see. He didn't have a phone. He didn't have a car.
So I had a car sometimes.
Eventually. But remember, we got an apartment, had a place upstairs so he could be there so we could find him.
Next door.
Because he was on a rooftop in Venice and just have to drive down there to get him, you know.
And he would just stay with different girlfriends every night, so you never knew where he was. But finally we got this place, and there was a place for him right next door, but he wasn't around there much.
What's interesting also is that both of your bands essentially had lead poets as opposed to lead singers, which is unusual.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm trying to recollect when I first saw Love, and I think it was at Beto Lito's. And did we go together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what year was that, approximately?
65, 64.
Had they already put out records at that time, or no?
No.
We were rehearsing, maybe?
Yeah, we were just starting.
Barely starting.
Maybe not even with the Doors yet. Maybe it was with Psychedelic Rangers or something.
Yeah.
But we went out to this club, and it was cool because it was, you didn't have to be 21 because we could never get in anywhere because we weren't 21.
How old were you at the time? You remember about?
Probably 18 or 17 or 18. So anyway, we walk in and they're playing, and I had never heard a loud band before. These were the loudest band I've ever heard. I mean, they had the big amps and shit. And before that, I'd only been to folk music, you know, Bud and Travis, Josh White, blues, you know, Muddy Waters stuff. And I had never heard anything like this. I mean, it was fucked, you know, it was cranking. And that just blew me away, how loud it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it obvious when you saw them what their influences were?
It was a culture shock, because here's this black lead singer who... he's wearing granny glasses like Roger McGuinn from the Byrds, psychedelic. But at the time, you know, afros and funk, you know, so they're electrified folk rock with a black lead singer singing this way out psychedelic reincarnation. It was mind blowing. Anyway, so, you know, there's this world we walked into and went, wow.
Oh, and the other thing was Johnny Eccles had this double neck guitar, which I'd never seen one of those before.
Yeah.
That was incredible, too.
Well, you know, okay, so we're playing the London Fog a few doors down from the Whiskey, this dump, and Love is at the Whiskey. And during the break, I go down there and stand outside and just drool over being in that band. And I'm thinking, I'm better than that drummer. And he's a sweet guy.
Yeah. But, Snoopy?
Yeah, Snoopy. You know, and actually, eventually on Forever Changes, they had studio
I think
players.
Just for one or two songs.
Yeah.
Is at least
Hal Blaine.
There's one version of the story where I think Hal Blaine played on just two songs.
Yeah.
And then the band kind of decided we better... and get serious, otherwise we're not going to get to play on the record. I don't know that. That's the lore, so we don't know what really happened.
That's correct.
Sounds right?
Yeah.
And Carol Kay played bass on a couple, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, Dennis Wilson, he didn't mind Hal playing on the stuff. He was cool with it.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, and I was thinking, I'm as good as these studio guys. Why am I not in Love?
Yeah.
And then... Arthur, you know, told the head of Elektra, Jack Holzman, to see us, which was such a gracious thing to do.
No, Emma, was it Arthur or Ronnie? Because Ronnie Heron always says it was her.
Well, she managed him, so. And then we skyrocketed past the band. Sorry, guys, but that was so.
I thought that's
they were our idols.
Yeah. It's the reason I wanted to talk to you guys is because most people know your band and many people don't know them. Yeah. And I thought it would be interesting for you to talk about it. It just gives people an understanding of what you guys saw and the fact that you traveled the world and spread the message of the Doors everywhere, whereas Love didn't really do that for Love. I don't understand the details, but I understand that Arthur didn't want to really leave Los Angeles very much.
I'll give you some details. He chain-smoked dope. And Forever Changes was just huge in England. It was like Sergeant Pepper time. And he would not get on a plane well, and they go did across go
over
the pond.
They did go over there once, I think.
I think well, later. I think a, may, yeah. May, yeah. Way
oh,
later.
Was that later?
They, I think
later.
When, maybe even when the band broke, may have broken up by then.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He might have been doing the hard stuff too by that time and was afraid bummer. To go on an airplane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, his reluctance didn't help at all.
When did you first meet those guys?
It's probably, I mean, I think I met Brian earlier, but mainly it was at the Whiskey when we finally got the job at the Whiskey. And
they House used, band.
Yeah, they used to hang out
And they
out
were the
there.
Headline. And every other group you've ever heard of.
So how did that work? What does the house band mean and what does the headliner mean? So we don't have that anymore.
We would start off the night, you know, 8 o'clock when the place was half full.
So you played there every night?
Or 6 nights a week.
6 nights yeah. a week.
Yeah, we had to join the union. Remember?
I think it was 9. We started at 9, played the first set, then the headliner played, then we played again, then they closed.
So it was like being an opening, you'd be the opening act, but you'd be the opening act for everybody all the time.
Yeah, for about yeah. a year, that's yeah. how for, it was. Yeah.
Just name them. Captain Beefheart, The Byrds, Van Morrison, Frank Zappa, yeah, them. Just on and on and on.
But the first one we did was Them. Van Morrison's band when he first had Gloria out.
Yeah.
And we got to be friends with them. And last night we got to play Gloria with them on stage, all of us.
Great.
Yeah. We really got fun. Some pictures of that. And that's when I thought his voice was the best ever. You know, just, I mean, Gloria, come yeah. on. Wow. And then, you know, when he came over and played at the Whiskey, we got to know him. And he was so shy, man. He was like... Yeah, worse than Jim, you know. And then one night at a party, he came and he was doing some of his new stuff. And he did Brown Eyed Girl, remember? Just him and a guitar. I went, wow.
He did snippets of Astral Weeks, too. I was thinking, he's so shy, he can't even talk. But then he grabs a guitar and, wow.
I would imagine by playing every night, the residency probably made you guys really good. Like when you play together, you just get better.
Yeah. I was there in New York. We did the same thing at a place called On Dean's Club near 59th Street Bridge.
Every night from 9 till 2. And Andy Warhol and all those giant people came in.
No, it was later there. Remember, we started at 11 and we go till 5.
Whatever.
Wow.
It's like just 5 sets a night.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, get good. The thing about practice, it really does make you good.
Well, that's the thing about today. Groups, they're lucky to get a gig on a weekend.
Yes.
You know, how can you get good like that?
And it's also different practicing in front of people versus playing in a room. Right. It's a whole different thing in front of people.
Sure is, yeah.
Well, then there's electronics. Jim said a long time ago, maybe in the future, music will be just made by one guy with a bunch of machines.
Did he say that?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Incredible.
There it is.
Yeah. And then Stevie Wonder came out with Talking Book a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And he played the drums on that as well as other shit. Oh, my God.
Amazing.
Yeah. Those were the days.
At that time, were you playing your own material or were you playing covers?
Both.
In the London Fog, we learned Woolly Bully and Gloria and crap to get by. And we'd sneak in our own stuff. And at the Whiskey, I'd say, remember the first set when nobody was there, we'd just do, what do we call it? Latin bullshit number 2. And we'd just jam on some Latin stuff.
Yeah.
And then as people started coming in, we'd lay on them. Fortunately, the times had changed and you didn't have to do rock hits and you could do your own stuff. And then we'd smack them with the end.
Did you end with the end every night?
Yeah, pretty much. Or Light My Fire would end.
We'd end with Light My Fire. Everybody would be dancing. And then the encore would be the end. And people would file out quietly. No applause. Holy shit. They were bludgeoned.
So great. So great.
But, you know, I want to jump for a sec. I'm thinking of the parallel between Arthur and Jim. I have this theory that a great song is a wedding between the way the lyrics fit with the melody. And damn, those two guys not only had these incredible words, but they're stitched to gorgeous melodies.
Yes.
You know, Arthur and Jim. And Jim couldn't play a chord on any instrument, but he said he thought of melodies to remember the words. Oh, my God. And, you know, Roadhouse Blues, that's not a difficult melody, but now I'm going to prove why I'm the drummer and not the singer. Before you slip into unconsciousness, that's some hard chord changes. That's
absolutely
not, you know, it's like jazzy, and he had it in his head.
Yeah.
Gifted.
Yeah. And he just, you know, it's not like he sat down at the piano and picked out the notes. He actually would do a little Acapulco Gold, and he said he heard a concert in his head.
Wow.
All he had to do was remember it.
Wow. And would those melodies always come after hearing the music, or might he sing you a melody and then you'd figure out what the song was?
Well, in those early days, it was, you know, he would have the melody in his head. And this is before I was even in the band. Ray would help him, you know, pick out the chords.
Yeah, Moonlight Drive kind of was etched out before.
Yeah, even Hello, I Love You was kind of like
but
that.
But when Robbie came along, the band was formed. And then Jim would just sing a cappella, and we'd, wait, hold it. F sharp, okay. Go on.
I mean, even in the songs that I wrote, he would often change the melody. He couldn't, you know, I would say, okay, sing it like this, you know, and he couldn't do it. You know, he wasn't a musician. So he would do something a little different, and it was usually better than what I had thought of.
He just naturally had a sense of melody.
Yeah. Like Gone Light My Fire, you know. My first melody was more like, you know, that it would be untrue. You know, da-da-da-da-da-da. But he just simplified it a little bit, and it actually was better.
Amazing.
And, you know, in the very beginning, he didn't have that deep baritone. He was so shy, wouldn't face the audience. But eventually, wow. And you think about other singers who blew their chords and had hive operations and stuff, and Jim could scream from the bowels like he was ripping his throat out.
Yeah,
and
but he
never
only,
had
he
trouble.
He only did it for 5 years. If he had
continued,
I'm sure he would have blown his voice
out. He never did while we were with him.
No, never. Never.
Never.
He never lost
Amazing.
His voice. I've had so many singers that I've played with over the years who, you know, couldn't make it through a whole show.
Yeah.
Tough, especially Doors songs. The keys they're in, they're meant for Jim's, his octave range was incredible.
It's an interesting thing about, there are certain bands like the Beatles, a lot of people cover Beatles songs. Not a lot of people cover Doors songs so much, but I think it has to do with the nature of the band is so unique that the sound of it is as important as the song. It's like the whole thing is one. And if you take you guys out of it, the song doesn't have the same life.
Yeah, if you go see these Doors cover bands.
I've never done
that. Never done that?
No.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, it's intimidating filling Jim's leather pants. No, okay, so I did L.A. Woman with the L.A. Philharmonic and Chris Martin from Coldplay.
Yes.
And he said to me, oh, man, how can I fill Jim's vocal cords? And I said, don't.
Yeah, don't try.
Do your,
be
you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing that he, you know, no vocal coaching, nothing. Never sung before us. Never wrote a song before us.
Yeah, I mean, he had the most incredible vocal range, and he was always on pitch. Never had to.
We never said you're sharp or flat.
Do you know what singers he liked? Like, who would you say he was inspired by?
He liked Elvis. He liked Sinatra.
That makes sense, though. Like, he sings more like Sinatra than most rock singers. You know, he really sang in that, the crooner
exactly.
style.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Willie Nelson has it, too.
Yeah.
There's a sense of phrasing where you sense the singer is so relaxed and it's effortless, and it is.
And Willie's obsessed with Frank as well.
Well, sure.
Oh, is that right?
And it's so identifiable. You hear two bars of Willie or Merle or Jim, and you go, that's them.
Yeah, it's nobody else. So unique.
Now, what was Arthur's influences?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Any ideas? I don't know.
Well, he must have liked the birds because of the glasses thing. I wish Arthur was still here.
Yeah.
And Brian.
And Jim.
Do you know anything about what their relationship was like?
It got more strained as time went on, I think.
Yeah. A songwriter competition kind of thing. Brian had the big hit, but Arthur had all this gorgeous, deep stuff, and I think there was some jealousy.
They were sure a unique group. I don't, how the hell did they get together, I wonder?
God knows. And they call themselves Love.
Incredible.
Isn't that beautiful?
It's incredible.
Really a eclectic group of people, you know, and it wasn't a stereotype then, you know, the peace sign and love. And
it was before the
real deal. It was so ahead of the curve, the people are still catching up.
Yeah.
You know, like we were on the shoulders of the beatniks, and then the punks are on the shoulders of the hippies, and the grunge is on the shoulders of the punks. So
you could say Love was a little bit punk.
A little.
You know?
It also makes sense when you say that you were on the shoulders of the beatniks and that both bands had poets.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like if we keep in mind that the beatnik era was just sort of what had just been going on in the culture.
Yeah.
So, you know, you sense a new wave. And I think Jim said, each generation wants to be different from the one before. And so the punks came along and dissed us for burning out. And they were right. But the message was there, the love thing, you know. So I get pissed off when people diss the 60s as failing. Hold it. Civil rights, peace movement, feminism are all seeds planted in the 60s. They're big seeds. So maybe they take hundreds of years for full fruition. So shut up and get out your watering can.
And also the
soapbox.
Clearly, the world is a different place than it was before the 60s. That was the turning point. You can say what you want about the 60s not accomplishing all that it meant to do, yet the world was transformed in the 60s. There's no question we live in a different culture. That was all the seeds of the 60s.
Right. Like a Renaissance time, like the 20s whatever.
What I was saying is you'd think we would have learned. we need another 60s right now is what we need.
Yeah.
It may happen.
Let's face it, music is the only thing that we all agree on and love. So let's use it to try to patch this mess up.
We're going to pause for a quick break. But we'll be back with The Doors' Robbie Krieger and John Densmore. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with Rick Rubin's conversation with Robbie Krieger and John Densmore.
What was the first gig that you did where you were in the band? Your first gig
the
in
first
the
gig
Doors.
Was at Hughes Aircraft. It was.
I don't remember it.
It was at a Labor Day party. Ray's mom worked at Hughes Aircraft, or his dad, so they needed a band for some occasion,
like a party.
You know. So we got together, and I can't remember the bass player, but he only had one string on his bass. And then Ray was on acid and totally freaked out. He was on a bummer acid trip. I don't know how he even played.
I don't remember the gig.
You don't remember?
No.
You blocked it out.
I remember the big warehouse. That's
Yeah. The gig was pretty weird. We played some Mingus, I think. And Jim tried to sing a couple of things. We didn't really have any songs worked up yet, you know. Yeah. So Jim and I both took Speed. I remember that.
Oh, my God. You drug addict. Really, the London Fog was the first.
No. Remember the party we played at my parents'
house? Well, there was parties.
No, but still, that counts.
Yeah.
It's curious. Okay. The first time you played in front of people.
Party at the Isaacson's house near UCLA. And we actually played a set, and that was pretty good.
Were you on that gig, that gay houseboat party out of Marina or somewhere?
San Pedro, I think.
And I know on the invitation it said, please remember the band is not part of our group. Members don't come on to the band. And we're playing, and I remember we got the nerve to play a ballad. And then everybody started kind of getting close. And there was a lot of shuffling down below in the boat. And I remember Ray daring me to go downstairs. Early Doors gigs.
Yeah. And then we played a gig for Moonfire. Remember?
What's Moonfire?
A gig?
Yeah, we played a gig. He had a party down right near where you live in the Uplifters. Remember?
Well, no, he was up at Topanga.
I know he was, but he rented this place right near your house.
You're jogging my memory. Moonfire was this heir to something.
Yeah, he had a lot of money, and he had a huge place up in Topanga, and he let all the hippies stay there and hang out and stuff.
And he was a militant vegetarian, and when we played Miami, he brought a lamb on stage, a cute little lamb.
And he gave it to Jim. Jim said, he said, if it weren't so young, I'd fuck it.
Oh, I was going to say, don't say that, Robbie, but go. You did. Okay.
Or did he really say that, or was that just in the movie?
It's just a joke?
No. Yeah, it was a joke.
It's not in the movie.
He would say that.
I think it is in the movie, actually.
Believe me, he would.
I don't think so.
The Oliver Stone movie.
Really?
Wasn't it in the movie?
I don't think so. I've seen the movie, and I don't remember that line.
Okay. Well, it's a real quick line.
Yeah.
If you go check it out again, you'll hear it.
A lot of eccentric folk around.
What was the idea of bringing the lamb on stage?
Because it's so cute. Don't eat meat.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, he was a vegetarian. Yeah.
I see.
Way before vegetarianism was cool.
Yeah. He was kind of a cool guy. Anyway, we played a party for him, and that was pretty early. That was one of our first gigs. Hmm. I remember having to drag my big Standell amp up there.
Yeah, we had a VW bus. And we schlepped all the stuff.
So we would just get gigs however we could get them. You know, I mean, we used to go to all the clubs and beg them to let us play there.
I remember, you know,
Ray
was with Dorothy in the beach house. And Jim and I, maybe you tagged along, we'd go to these bars on Hollywood Boulevard that would never have a band anyway. And we'd go in there. Can we play? But we wanted to do something, even though it seemed fruitless. You know, it was a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week campaign. You know how it is to launch anything creative.
Yes.
Whether it's a book or a movie or what, it's Herculean to sell the damn thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's very hard to break through.
We didn't even have a manager, I think, until Light My Fire hit.
Wow. Amazing.
And it's been downhill ever since.
It's also funny that in today's world, we don't think of a band of the stature of the Doors playing at house parties. It's just fascinating to imagine that world, because now when young artists start, the mechanisms are in place for finding an audience and then finding gigs. There's like an industry around it now.
Yeah.
Whereas then it really was a clean slate. And I remember seeing old film of you guys playing where it seemed like the sound system wouldn't even fill the places you were playing.
Oh, yeah.
Just tiny little sound systems.
We used a guitar amp for a vocal mic, you know.
And
it's always hard to hear the vocals. Poor Jim. You know, he never had monitors.
But it's also a testament to what a good singer he was if he could sing like that without hearing himself.
I guess they had him at the Whiskey, but... Yeah, I mean, I think that was good for building his vocal cords.
He'd have to.
Something the Beatles talk about was that they would sing their harmonies going from gig to gig in the van and practice singing, and they were so good at it that they didn't have to hear each other to be able to sing in harmony because they could never hear each other when they were performing.
No kidding. Yeah. Mm. Wow. And now we have in-ear monitors. Different world. You know, I changed my answer to the question. For years, people would say, well, if Jim was around now, would he be clean and sober? And I go, nah, kamikaze drunk. And now, in the last few years, I've thought about Clapton and Eminem, and it's a different time. Yeah, sure. Why not?
If he was alive, he'd have to be sober.
Yeah.
Yeah, otherwise he wouldn't be alive.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, but good point. So, yeah. I like saying that because it's different.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we don't get to have them around anymore. Would be great.
Absolutely. We didn't know them and we miss them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you see the Stones still playing and stuff. I get really jealous when I see that, you know.
How quickly did it change from being the house band to things getting big for you guys?
It was pretty quick. I mean, it was, you know, when Light My Fire came in, that was the whole game changer. Because before that, we put out Break On Through as the first single, and it didn't do very much.
We called up a lot. This is Fred Schwartz. Would you please play that Break On? And then they got on to us. It made it to number 11.
All of our friends would be calling, because that's how you got on the radio before, you know. You have to have audience calling in.
It's interesting how that song is so admired now.
Yes.
And then it was a struggle to get it out there because it was just so different. You know, Bossa Nova. I don't know what.
Starts off with the Bossa Nova drums.
So,
I mean, nobody's ever done that since, no, even.
No. I think Forever Changes might have a Bossa Nova on it.
I think
it
so. Might. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, the way he played Bossa Nova,
very unusual.
No rock drummers, yes, even today, can do that.
Yes. Also, I think that the fact that you had a classically trained pianist in the group really separated you from everyone else.
That's true.
It's a very one-of-a-kind sound. I think the same holds true for maybe the Zombies.
Ooh,
you know, I don't. Not that I relate the Zombies and the Doors, but both of you don't sound like anyone else.
Yeah.
Mainly because of the keyboards, as such a featured instrument. Because like the Rolling Stones usually had someone playing piano in the group more often than not, but it wasn't as much of a focus.
Yeah,
it was more of a support instrument.
Well, like on Yes, they had that as well.
And then the Ray's genius of these licks. Da, 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 da. Whoa, that's etched on all our brains.
Yeah. And it sounds like when you just sang that, it sounds like Bach.
It is.
Isn't it?
I had the chords, these kind of weird chords, and he just naturally just came up with the Bach to go over it.
Yeah. It is.
It was pretty amazing, really. And, you know, Riders on the Storm. God, you listen to that solo. It's genius, you know. I've had so many keyboard players that play with me to play Ray stuff, and a lot of them know Light My Fire and Riders note for note.
Wow.
And but it still never quite sounds like Ray, you know.
It's the feel.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, Ray never played those solos alike, the same, every night.
It was just an improv. Yeah, it was an improvisation.
Yeah, it was, you know, when we recorded that stuff, it was one take, and that's just how it was that night.
So in addition to the solos being different, how free were the arrangements? Like, might a song go longer live, or?
Depended on the song. The epics, the end, when the music's over, they had big sections where we'd vamp.
And they would be different every night, and
Jim
the length would go.
Fuck around with any poem he wanted to, you know.
I see.
We'd chase him around.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of songs, they would grow every night, you know.
Yes.
Because it started off real short. Like, the end was just a 2-minute love song when it started. And then as time went on, it got longer and longer.
But, you know, Ravi and I went to Ravi Shankar's Kanara School of Indian Music and got heavily influenced by that. So the end got this droning.
This was even back then you did this.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So that's where that raga,
I had a sitar
influence came in.
I actually had a sitar.
A traditional sitar, not an electric sitar.
Yeah, and John had the tabla drums.
Wow.
And we actually went to this school, the Kanara school, that Ravi Shankar started.
Yeah, actually Ravi came and gave a lecture to us one time.
Amazing.
And we're in our 20s, and he says you should channel your sexual energy into playing your instrument. What?
Yeah, and later I found out that he really didn't keep to that very well himself.
There was enough left over after putting it in the music we
and
could still
Alaraca,
use it.
And Alaraca, too. He was quite the ladies.
Oh, well, he liked the whiskey, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
So you're saying he was a human being?
Yeah.
Kind of like Maharishi.
Right.
He liked
Mia Farrow. There's a rumor
that
some of your band members met each other at TM. Is that?
Yeah, that's true.
That's where we met.
Tell me the story.
Ravi and I are fooling around with legal psychedelics, and then Ravi says there's this Indian sage coming to town, and I'm thinking, meditation might be a little less shattering on the nervous system. And this is before the Beatles, a year or two, I don't know, got onto Maharishi.
Yeah, because we were doing it pretty much every weekend. And we were
doing,
you know, I was turning LSD.
Yeah.
So I was turning all my friends onto it. And this one guy had a bad reaction, man. He, you know.
Yeah, well, did you douse him or?
Yeah, I think I gave him a little speed with it or something extra to boost it. But anyway, he had a bad reaction and I felt horrible, you know. And so I said, shit, there's got to be a better way to do this, you know. So my buddy who had been to India met Maharishi and talked him into coming back here.
And, what was your friend's name?
Peter Wallace. And so his brother and I were buddies, Keith. So the first Maharishi meeting was at his house. And that's where Ray and John, Ray happened to be there, right? And John. John and I knew each other already, but...
So Ray came up to me and said, I hear you're a drummer. You want to be in a band? And I said, well, I'm a professional. I don't know. I'll come down and jam. And then, as I said, later, Ray's brothers dropped out and Robbie came in.
Was Jim already in the band at that
time?
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, you know, he stood in the corner with his back to us, shy. He couldn't, it was, I like.
And when we say already in the band, it means, you know, months.
It was
maybe.
Actually, it was Rick and the Ravens was the band. It was Ray's brother's band at that point.
I see.
And Jim used to sing Louie Louie once in a while.
Right.
And then they started, and then Jim came up with these couple of songs.
It's the words.
And he said he wants to call it The Doors. And then that's when John met, and I met Ray.
So I thought, okay, he's not the next Mick Jagger, but these words, man, I want to drum to these words. They're so wild.
We'll be right back with more from Robbie Krieger and John Densmore after a quick break. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with The Doors, Robbie Krieger, and John Densmore.
Anything more about love? That's what we came here to talk about. Not The Doors, right?
Oh, yeah, we got off.
Either way, we can go wherever you're comfortable going is fine.
We got self-centered.
Anyway, like I said, I kind of met Brian earlier on, and I used to see him play and stuff, and he looked kind of like Brian Jones, you know? He had that nice hairdo and stuff. So I decided I want my hair to look like that. And so I got this hair straightener, you know, because I had the real Afro hair back then. So me and Billy Wolf, we both had the Afro kind of hair, Jewish kink.
Jufro.
Yeah.
Lovingly referred to it as a Jufro.
So we got this stuff, I forget what it was called, but it really worked on me, man. I looked like fucking Brian, you know, and even Wolf said, "Hey, man, you look like that jerk Brian McLean." And so that's right before I met the Doors, before I tried out for the Doors.
Yes.
So I had the good hair, man. I think that's why I got the job. And then about a couple months later, when it grew back out, and I remember Jim going, "What happened to your hair, man?" But by that time, they needed me.
Why did your friend refer to him as a jerk, Brian?
Oh, it was just a friendly kind of a saying. He was a
competitive
jerk.
Guitar player.
Yeah. We were jealous of him because he was in a big group.
You know, it's interesting, long hair. During that time, on the both coasts, there were long hairs. But in the middle of the country, And one time after a New York gig, Ray and I and his girlfriend Dorothy drove across the country because we had no money. And so we got a car we could deliver as long as we paid the gas. And we stopped at a diner in Ohio. And you know, Ray and I had long hair and Dorothy's Japanese. We go in and holy shit, there's these guys at the counter with red paint on the back of their necks. And they're scowling at us, and it was scary.
I mean, even in L.A. at that time, we were like the only long hairs around, pretty much. I mean, I remember one time me and Jim went to eat at Ships, I think it was. Remember Ships?
Yeah.
I don't think you were there.
Coffee shop in Westwood.
Yeah. And we started, you know, sat down, ordered and stuff, and there was some Marines next to us. And they started giving us shit, right? And so we kind of started giving them shit back. And were you there?
Nope.
And so finally we started to leave, and they came out and grabbed us. And the one guy was beating Jim with a payphone, you know. And Jim was just laughing. He goes, "Call the cops, ha, ha, ha." He didn't mind being beat up. You remember?
I wasn't there, but it's reminding me of these guys in Ohio were like saying to the waitress, "Shirley, you got a scissors? Some of these girls need a haircut."
Yeah. No, I remember quite a few times that happened.
And it's interesting now, you know, then the punks come along and shave their heads. And so now, whatever, anything's cool. You know, I like it. There's a liberation.
I bet you there's still places you could find in the United States where you could go and not feel welcome.
I'd say.
It's a big country.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big country.
There's still plenty of places.
So would you say that spirituality played a role in the Doors?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It wasn't talked about.
As much as Jim tried to squash it.
I think he was a searcher.
We were meditating.
Yeah. He was trying to find out what was inside in his own way, you know.
It's all different versions of, we could call it self-medicating. In the case of TM, it turns out to be healthier for you than, let's say, alcohol.
Yeah.
But it's definitely dealing with our inner self, trying to find some peace.
Yeah, something more. What else is there, you know?
So did you guys practice TM?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Still do.
We did TM.
Still do. Great.
We did TM for like the whole career. Twice a day, we go, we're going in the vocal booth for 20 minutes. Do what you guys got to do. And Robbie and I'd go meditate.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what grounded us through that craziness.
Yeah, I think
so.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'd say.
Amazing.
And we actually took Jim to meet Maharishi one time.
Wow. How was that?
Didn't turn out that well.
Well, okay.
What happened? What happened?
Jim didn't sign up, but I do remember him saying he wanted to look in his eyes and see if he had any knowledge. And he said he did, but he's not going to meditate.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. By that time, it was bigger. The Beatles had started doing it.
I see.
And after the lecture, we brought Jim up to real close to Maharishi and tried to introduce him.
I do remember, you know, I was raised Catholic. I'm now a renegade, of course, but I remember first time being in Maharishi's presence and feeling a love vibe like I did not get this from those priests in the black tourniquets. Wow, I want this.
Yeah.
You know?
I never got to meet Maharishi. I learned TM when I was 14, and like you guys, I realized that it had a big impact on my life.
Yeah, I noticed how you're sitting.
No question. No question.
I wish I could still do that.
I include that as part of who I am. You know, I don't think I would be the same person without that.
I think of Maharishi as kind of jump-starting this whole thing. Indian music, Ravi Shankar, the whole culture, Hindu culture, it all got a big push from him, really, and it's still here.
Absolutely. You
know, in various forms, and what a gift.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is in the 60s, there was no internet, and wow, the Beatles happened to be experimenting with psychedelics like we were. The Beatles, or musicians over there, all kind of got into meditation like we were. What's going on here? Carl Jung's archetypal undercurrents across the globe to get cosmic, but yeah. Something going on,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it wasn't people imitating each other. It was just, it was blossoming in the culture.
Well, the Beatles did imitate us. We were meditating before they were.
Yeah, right, ha ha.
If you want to get technical about it.
And you were taking acid before them, too.
Probably. Actually, when I was in college, I had real Sandoz acid. Yeah, that was the stuff they... who was the guy that was doing those? Alpert. Who was later Ram Dass, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah. Richard Alpert.
Who's the guy who made it? The guy in San Francisco, Owsley.
Yeah.
So Owsley comes to one of our gigs, and he comes backstage, and he says, "You guys need a bass player, man. There's a hole in your sound, you know." And he leaves, and I said to Ray, "Wow, we're making the king of acid nervous. I think we're on the right track here."
Yeah, how did it work out that you decided not to have a bass player? It's interesting.
We tried. We had a girl bass player for a minute. We sounded like the Stones, some white blues band or something.
I see.
Yeah, we tried a few bass players, and we always had a bass pretty much on the records.
Yeah.
Well, that was to make up for, there was no Moog synthesizer, so Ray's keyboard, Ray found this keyboard bass, and then we went, that's it. We don't need a bass player. But recording, it's mushy.
It worked on some songs, like Break On Through has
Keyboard bass.
And The End, and a couple of other ones.
But other ones that needed that plucking from a string. With various bass players overdubbed Ray's lines.
Yes.
Actually, on Backdoor Man and Soul Kitchen was me overdubbing the bass.
Oh, there was a rumor that John Sebastian played bass on one of your albums.
No, he played harmonica.
On
Roadhouse. Harmonica.
Roadhouse.
Really?
Okay, so you'll notice that John Sebastian, the harp player credited on Roadhouse is G. Pugliese, which was a synonym for John Sebastian.
Well, no, that was his real name.
Real name?
That's his real name.
Really?
Giovanni Pugliese is his real name.
Really?
Yeah. He didn't think that would sound good as a rock and roll name.
I thought he
But I had heard that he didn't want to be associated with the Doors.
No, it wasn't that. It was his record company didn't want him to use his name.
Right. But also the Doors, you know, I mean, there's this wonderful flower power thing with the birds and all the mamas and papas. And we loved it. But we were the underbelly, the undeclared Vietnam War, the shadow side.
Anti-flower power.
And people did not like us. It made them nervous to be associated with us because we were dark.
I don't think that was it.
I'm glad we disagree. Now, I heard just a little earlier from our moderator that tension creates creativity. So fuck you. Well, no, fuck you.
That's a good one. Okay.
So I see the TM's been working.
Okay.
Was it when you got to play at the Hollywood Bowl, did that feel like a big deal at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Sure did. The venue. I think we were one of the first. Did the Beatles play there before us? Only the Beatles had played
there. But of course, you know, they made us have a decibel limit and that ruined it.
Yeah. And we had, that was the first time that we actually brought real cameras and movie cameras and stuff to film the show. So it looks real good, but...
And Jim took acid and didn't tell us.
Great. Well, why would he tell us?
And it was fine, but there was something...
It just wasn't a good show.
I remember saying to you, coming off stage, Robbie, what? And you said... He took acid. Great.
So he got, and sometimes when he's on acid, he was great, but this time he got real introverted and he kind of just didn't move around much. And
he saw a moth on the astroturf and picked it up and was examining it.
And then it didn't help that his girlfriend Pam was sitting with Mick Jagger right in the front row.
Right. Because Jagger went out to dinner with us before, and we wanted to be really good for him. And damn it. I mean, it's good.
Yeah, what did he say? Somebody asked him about the
joke. Said, it was in Melody Maker, the Doors are nice chaps, but they went on a bit long.
But, I mean, it looks great. Looks good.
What was the last show you guys did?
New Orleans.
I was trying to forget about that one.
Was it a bad one?
Yeah.
Yeah. The night before was Dallas. And we were trying out Riders Live, Riders on the Storm. And we were kind of, wow, maybe we could kind of be a jazz rock thing. Maybe it's going to be different. And the next night, Jim was drunk.
Too drunk, yeah.
Sat on the drum riser in the middle, just his head down. Middle of the show. I walk around and sit next to him. Hey, man, what do you want to play next? Hello?
And isn't that when Ray said he saw Jim's soul leave his body or something like
that? Ray said he saw his spirit exit.
So that was the last show we attempted. Yeah.
I was lobbying for a year to get off the road. Because in the studio, if he's too messed up, we go home. But in front of 10,000 people. And we were really good live in the beginning, just pin drop time.
Do you think success played a role in his destruction? Self-destruction?
Some.
Probably.
It's not just that.
Yeah, I think it would have happened anyway.
You do?
Yeah.
Here's a line someone said to me, blew my mind. Maybe if Jim hadn't met you guys, he would have died sooner.
Interesting.
Whoa!
Interesting.
Food for thought?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at least he had something to do.
He channeled.
Yeah, I mean, he lived to be on stage, yeah.
He enjoyed performing.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. I wouldn't have known that if you didn't say it.
Really?
Say it.
No, are you kidding?
Wouldn't have known that.
That's
Well, because he seemed so scary and serious and dark and weird, but he knew. When you're performing, you can feel if the audience is Madison Square Garden or a club, that's one person. And the performer... is a duet or an orchestra. That's the other person. And the two of you are going to dance tonight. And the mystery and excitement is, what is it going to be? A waltz? A salsa? A riot? You know, and that's what's so kinetic about it.
Energetically, you feel that interaction.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why bands like Your Band, bands like Love, bands like the Grateful Dead, for that matter. Today there seems to be more and more artists who just are putting on a show, and people are watching this thing, but there's very little interaction. You know, like the show is the same every night. Whereas you guys would change according to what the vibe. Were feeling. Some songs would have long parts that got longer if it felt good that night. It wasn't so scripted. But you guys also were influenced by jazz, and it wouldn't be unusual to have a long song in jazz. So bringing that jazz sensibility into popular music, super cool.
And Ravi Shankar. I mean,
yeah.
We sat next to the man, and ragas are 15 minutes.
Yes.
And Ravi was like, you know, you in America want to climax too soon. You know, take your time with the foreplay. Metaphorically.
Yes.
And we were steeped in that.
Yes.
When I first met Ray, he played me Ravi Shankar's theme from Panther Panchali, and it had jazz guys on it, jazz and raga. It's like, wow, let's soak up this.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Cool.
What a pleasure.
Thank you guys, man, for coming and talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Thanks to Robbie Krieger and John Densmore for sharing so many incredible stories about Jim Morrison and The Doors. You can hear all of our favorite Doors songs on my playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music is by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.